Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. A lot of voice modalities in that one.
Yeah, that's nice.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just feeling wild today. We released a poll today, and people who listen to the podcast now know what that means. We've got the Texas Politics Project poll team in the house today to talk about some of the results. I'm happy to be joined by my friends and colleagues, Darren Shaw, professor of government and the Frank C. Irwin Chair of Local Government at the University of Texas at Austin. How are we today?
We're doing well. Good morning, Professor Henson.
Happy to have you here today. Even if it sounds like we want to go into it. You've had a little bit of a rough week. We're here to
that's its own podcast.
As my wife would say, we're here to rock you like a baby. Okay,
I need it.
And yes, you do. And Dr. Joshua Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. Josh, you've been out running around doing some child responsibilities this morning, but here you are.
I'm happy to be here as well. Happy to rock some more babies.
As is usually the case when we're fortunate enough to have Darren with us, let's start with some of the national numbers in the poll. Mm-hmm. Just jump right into it, particularly Donald Trump standing in Texas, a state he won very comfortably. So, Josh, let's start with you. First, you know, give us the overall, 411, which nobody knows what that means anymore, I guess.
Right.
the overall disclosure on the poll sample and all that, and then, lead us through some of the key Trump numbers.
Yeah, sure. So as usual, this was a poll of 1,200 registered voters in Texas. We collect the data using YouGov over the internet. That doesn't mean we randomly, allow people to do this. It's actually a sample that is created to match gender, race, age, and education levels of the Texas registered voter population. Survey was conducted from February 14th to the 24th, and if you want to read more, it is all available on our website in pretty solid detail. So where are we now? Well, Trump is entering the office in a pretty high place in Texas. He had 52% approval and 38% disapproval in this survey. 53% had a favorable opinion of Trump in February, 41% had an unfavorable opinion. These were all highs in the time series, including 92% approval among Republican and only 4% disapproval. Just for a point of context, he entered in February of 2017 polling with 46% approving, 44% approving, 81-10 among Republicans. So he was at 46, he's at 53 entering his second, or 52 entering his second term, 6-point bump among Republicans, about an 11-point bump. So it's a pretty good place to start, especially when you think about the fact that, most people kind of limp into their second terms. This is a little bit different, obviously.
Well, he had a break.
He had a break. It's true. It's a nice break.
Maybe it's a reset.
No limping here. He had a nice break.
Right.
So, Darren, you've obviously been doing a lot of national polling in the last few weeks, but what do you make of what's going on here, and how does it align with what you're seeing nationally?
It's very consistent with what we've seen nationally, displaced upwards a bit because Texas is a little more Republican, a little more conservative than the nation as a whole is. I like to go back to compare where Trump was. I believe the first poll we did in his first term where we asked mm-hmm. approval was June 2017. Mm-hmm. At that point, he was 43 approved, 51 disapproved, so minus 8. Mm-hmm. And he's now plus 14. Now, that was 6 months in, or roughly four or five months in, to his first administration. But as you guys mentioned, you're not supposed to gain support as you head into your second term. You're supposed to have alienated constituencies and made people, disappointed people with, uneven performance across some range of issues. So I think what's even more surprising is, given that we think opinions on Trump are so fixed, that this isn't spectacular. And this is not George W. Bush after 9/11 territory, but...
Or Willie Nelson. Certainly not Willie Nelson.
Or Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah,
but,
no.
But by Trump standards, he's as high as he has been.
Well, that's the thing about politics, right? I mean, you look at these numbers, and I mean, one of the things that sort of, I think, doing this for so long, you're like, man... He's doing really well. It's like, where is he at? 55.
Yeah.
Right? But that's sort of the nature of these things. Is if you're sitting there above 50, really almost, even in a state as, Republican as Texas is, that's pretty good. I mean, you're doing pretty well here, right?
And the underlying dynamics are, and I think we commented on this spring of last year, Trump has absolutely locked down Republicans.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's possible that he will lose them given circumstances. I remember thinking that George W. Bush would never go below 40%, that his base was so tight. And then after Katrina, you know, he cratered. He went into the low 30s, I think, on approval. Yeah. So anything can happen, of course, right, as we know in politics.
And his Republican numbers are, I mean, they're right, they got nowhere to go but down. I mean, exactly. 92% yeah, approval among Republicans right now.
Because
unbelievable.
When I see these top line numbers, and Josh can probably have the same reaction, my thought was, whoa, he must be, you know, killing it with independents and some Democrats.
Those haven't moved much.
No, he's okay.
Yeah.
You know, but his support amongst the Republican base is considerable. And there is sort of an issue basis for that, which we can talk about as we get into the poll.
I was going to say, you know, I mean, I was going to ask you a question, actually. I was wondering, outside the issue basis, I mean, I also wondered, you know, as you joked before, you know, he took a break, but also he's not being compared to his first term. He's being compared to the last guy.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, you know, how much did that also play into this in some ways? Because, I mean, for Republicans, and you see this all over the poll, you know, it's morning in America, right? Like, everything's going to be great now, at least on some levels, and there's some limitations to that. But I wonder to what extent, you know, this is pro-Trump and how much of this is sort of relief that Biden is gone.
Yeah, I think the number that really stuck out to me in these overtly political numbers was the rating of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we want to, you know, save that for an entree.
Yeah.
But, you know, we ask basically, was it fave, unfave,
or
was it
fave, unfave on the
fave,
parties?
Fave on the parties. And let me sort of make sure I'm referencing the right numbers here. You can go to our website to check this stuff out. But I want to say the Democrats were something like minus 20.
They were the worst that they have been really almost in the whole history of measuring favorability towards the Democratic Party.
So for the Republicans, the number was plus 5. It was mid single digits in terms of,
but they were also on a high.
Right.
I mean,
exactly. Well, ratings of the Republican Party have been at best, you know, at sea level.
Right.
But more often than not, they're what we call underwater, more unfavorable than favorable. Mm-hmm. Republicans are now above water.
Plus 5.
Plus 5. And the Democrats are close to minus 20, I believe.
It's pretty far down. I got right here.
Yeah, yeah.
Democrats, so are minus 22.
Minus 22.
Which is atrocious.
That's a stunning.
It's atrocious.
Even in a Republican state, that's pretty bad.
And, you know, Republicans tend not to view Democrats very favorably. But what this shows, the internals, are that Democrats aren't all that happy with their own party right now. They're not.
Well, I don't want to drag us down to a rabbit hole, but, you know, we're recording Wednesday afternoon, even though I said today, because we're going to release on Thursday to coincide with the release of the polling data. But, you know, this conversation you guys are having, that as we look at these numbers about Trump's position and compared to just how negative views are of the Democrats and how hobbled the Democrats are right now, and the contrast issue all on display in Trump's, what I saw of Trump's speech last night and what I've read about it. Mm-hmm. I only saw about half of it. But, you know, Democrats in disarray, sort of reduced to handheld signs and waving their canes and getting kicked out of the chamber.
In Texas. And Texas Democrats have been on full display throughout this process. And I we're armchair Monday morning quarterbacks or armchair analysts on this. But I agree with you, Jim. The optics of it, what do you think? I mean, you know, Trump's ability to filibuster, he's surpassing Clinton now in terms of the length of these speeches. Mm-hmm. But he's on the offense. And the stuff he's doing, people are rooting him on, you know, the attacking, you know, bureaucracies, going, you know, Doge and these sorts of things play very well with the Republicans. They play well with some Democrats. And when you don't have a president, when you don't have an heir to the throne, which the Democrats don't at this point, you're kind of left open to whoever wants to volunteer themselves as the spokesperson for the party becomes the spokesperson for the party. I'm not sure Al Green waving a cane is necessarily what the Democrats would devise if they had a bunch of focus groups.
The coverage have made it clear that Hakeem Jeffries had really practically begged his members not to do what many of them
did. And Pelosi had said, we had called, and she was the one who ripped his State of the Union speech in half and then quartered it a few years back, had said, times call for a more tempered response. And by the way, the strategy is clear, which is let him stew in his own. Let's see him get out of this particular predicament. But it seems to me the more the Democrats talk on these things, the kind of worse hole they dig. And that's evident in our Texas numbers, which is Democrats aren't happy with their own party right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that. I think that's right. I mean, that was the thing. I think I watched the whole speech last night, all of it. And then you get to the end and all the networks are like, well, you see the sort of disheveled Democrats kind of walking right. out. As, you know, they're really high-fiving each other on the side instead of like... And just somebody said, you know, well, this is kind of a pretty indicative of the Democratic response so far. And like, I think you see that in those numbers.
Mm. Right. And you mentioned the Texas Democrats. I should also, in terms of local color, the Democrats either left early or, you know, had to kind of skulk or storm out, you know, during Trump's exits, you know, and that it's that scrum where everybody's kind of angling to get some acknowledgement from the president or get in the shot, et cetera. Mm. You know, a lot of Texas Republicans prominent in that.
I saw Chip Roy a lot.
Yeah, well, Chip,
which is interesting.
This is bitchy, and I apologize, but the Chip Roy thing, and I'm going to say this, having acquainted with Representative Roy a little bit. If somehow this gets back to him, I don't think he'll take it too personally. But and you could tell he was trying to get in there in that camera shot and get Trump's attention, and he just couldn't do it.
He
kind of tapped his arm at once, I think, and Trump, somebody else was hugging up on him. And then further down, you know, to show how it's done, Lance Gooden came in from the side on the angle, got a one-armed hug, got a little. Yeah. So if you like the semiotics of that stuff, go back and find that.
Chip is no Sheila Jackson Lee.
Look, Chip's relationship, Chip Roy's relationship with Trump is more probably, you know, he has not bent the knee entirely as others have.
Yeah.
So, speaking of bending the knee and others, we included some other national figures in here just to track some of the figures that have entered into the Trump orbit. And, you know, in part because we've pulled on some of these figures before. So we also asked for favorability ratings of J.D. Vance, Elon Musk, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and Marco Rubio. All of whom got, I think, a little love in the speech last night. Maybe not Robert. Yeah, even Robert.
He did. Oh, yeah, he did.
That was early on. I read about that, but I didn't
see
it.
There's one later, too.
Yeah. But I definitely saw, you know, the Rubio part, which was uncomfortable. But
well, he was very tired.
I think uncomfortable. If you Google Marco Rubio and uncomfortable now, you're going to get a lot of hits. What did you guys make of these numbers? Anything that really stuck out?
I mean, I think obviously we were interested in where the Musk numbers were going to go. We asked about Musk as part of a larger battery back in December before he assumed this new role, you know, sort of is, you know, I don't even know, co-executive or whatever.
Right.
And I mean, I think the interesting question would be, I mean, to my mind, I was sort of expected his numbers to shift some. And the question was, how are they going to shift? Was it going to be all Democrats or Republicans going to be upset? Because there was a lot of sort of talk about Republicans' constituents being a little bit unsure about some of these efforts. But for the most part, things have settled in a partisan way, right? So Musk saw his favorabilities drop 6 points from December to February, from 54 to 48. His unfavorables went up 11 from 30 to 41, but his attitudes among Republicans remain relatively static. About 80% have a favorable view of him, only about 6 to 8% have an unfavorable view. Among Democrats, the share having an unfavorable view increased 24 points from 59 to 83%, not surprising. Those with a favorable view decreased from 16 to 11. So, you know, they kind of look like a politician's number, which I think is fine. It's unfortunate
for
him.
For better or for worse, that's where he is right now.
That's where he is. I mean, unfortunately for him, he's a businessman too. So, you know, there's probably some externalities to all this. But I mean, you know, more than anything, it's not as though he has kind of cut through the polarization in some ways by being as disruptive as he's been. And I think that's the most interesting out of this for me. I mean, J.D. Vance clearly recovered. You know, I mean, Republicans came around. He's at this point 48 favorable, 36 unfavorable. You know, again, high favorabilities among Republicans. So that was sort of what I took out. I mean, anything else you were looking at in there?
Yeah, I mean, I thought we were very interested in the Musk number. And the Musk number moved, as you say, I think, in predictable directions. Some people might be disappointed there's not more negative backlash. But, you know, and the Musk numbers, I mean, you know, his Republicans are accepting him as one of their own.
Yep.
You know, his favorability ratings among Republican, you know, very high, you know, not as high as Trump, but, you know, 82 favorable is pretty good.
Yeah, 54 very favorable.
Right.
Yeah,
so
I think that very unfavorable number did strike me. He's at 34%. Musk is 34% very unfavorable, which is almost right on top of Trump's unfavorable number.
Yeah.
So I think what's clearly happened is that, you know, the Democratic Party and Democratic identifiers have basically decided that he's responsible. Musk is responsible for the Trump agenda, and they don't just dislike him, they really dislike him.
Yeah, among Democrats, he jumped from 59 unfavorable in December to 83 unfavorable.
Yeah.
In February. That's pretty big.
That's pretty big. Yeah, it's a pretty big jump.
Right. I would point out also that there's this interesting bump up amongst Trump and the administration. It's not totally evident in the FAVE numbers, although it's a little bit there. You certainly see with Vance.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that in the Texas Republican numbers nearly as much.
Interesting.
It partly might be that we've pivoted to a policy season in Texas, and as Republicans proposed. But I think it's actually deeper than that. I think it's the nature of things that they're fighting for here, that the Texas Republicans are fighting for, are not the same thing as the nature that of the things that Trump and Vance and, you know, relatedly Musk are going after, right? The national agenda is government inefficiency, government waste, government fraud, this stuff that really resonates with populists.
Where are you going to find that in Texas?
That's an uncomfortable conversation. Uncomfortable conversation you've owned government for 25
exactly.
years.
That's not really an option for the Texas Republicans. So their focus obviously is on the meat and potato things we talk about, plus things are a little less more controversial, school choice.
I would take it one step further, but also, if you think about the last couple of the agenda hasn't even changed.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if you think about how static it is, I mean, one of the things, I was giving a presentation last week, and I was talking about, what to expect on economic attitudes. I'm saying, look, from what we've seen, we should expect, we're going to talk about this. National economic attitudes is obviously jumble, right? Because of a change of the administration. We know that people view these things through a partisan lens. But when you think about Texas, it's like the opposite of an experiment, right? We shifted everything at the national level. Now we're going to see all the attitudes shift. And then here in Texas, we kept everything the same. And it's not only the leadership, the statewide leaders, the majorities in the legislature, but even the agenda, immigration, property taxes, school vouchers. Why would we expect, sort of that positive? Because if anything, it's like we're doing the same thing. We're doing water again too?
Yeah.
Okay, got it. It's hard to imagine people getting too excited about something that they just apparently fixed 2 years ago and 4 years ago, right?
I find this a really...
But I do think it's interesting.
My point is more of an observational one, which is just that it's interesting. And this is, I think, a perfect example of inductive theorizing, which is we look at the data and we say, well, geez, Trump is up, Vance is up.
We may have just renamed
right
this
direction.
Podcast.
Not yet.
But you look at it and then you go, whoa, that's probably because of the things that Josh was talking about. But I do find I hadn't thought of that in a vacuum. That when you've owned the keys to the car, as Jim sort of hinted at, for a long period of time, populist messaging becomes a little problematic. So that's something to keep our eyes on, I think.
Yeah,
the couple things I want to come back to on that. I mean, the state national thing I had pegged. I think I want to talk about a couple more things. I want to come back to that. Yeah, the populism thing really resonates, but I did a panel yesterday with Kurt Weiland, right? So we talked a lot, about the Trump administration. We talked a lot about populism. Yeah. And it was an interesting – I was just talking to somebody. I mean, the construct really wound up kind of dominating the discussion in a way that was not anticipated, even though I should have. I want to circle back to all that, but this all does touch on the economic stuff. So let's talk a little bit – it's related to Trump, and I think – there's interesting connective tissue here between the state stuff, state views of the state, views of what's going on in national politics, but also the different perspectives that you're kind of getting at in the policy agenda, I think is also manifesting in this economic stuff in interesting ways with some other cross currents. So Josh, tell us a little bit about the various economic measures we had, and then let's move through a couple of them.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, as always, we ask people to assess, sort of the quality of the national economy, the state economy, their own personal economic situation. We've also been, of late asking people to sort of about to project into the future and whether they expect the economy to get better or worse. And then we've delved deeper into, what of the potential economic concerns that are out there, are the ones that are really sort of most important to them? What are the ones that they're very concerned about, extremely concerned about versus somewhat? And you see a pretty wide range of people less concerned currently about, let's say, the stability of banks and financial institutions like they might have been in 08 and 09, more concerned about prices. And I will say, I'll add a little bit more color to that from the open-ended as we go.
Yeah.
We also ask questions specifically about the impact of tariffs, both in the short and the long term, since this is one of sort of, if not the biggest sort of economic policy kind of on offer that is almost this certain to happen in some form or fashion, if it's not already happening, I guess, now. And I just say that because we'll see what happens with the tax cuts or not.
Sure.
That's why I'm just sort of pegging that. But we asked people to sort of get a sense of their reaction to that. I think we should start there because that's actually some really interesting results as far as, you know, I'm concerned in terms of looking at this stuff. So, you know, we asked people, do you think basically that the U.S. increasing tariffs is going to result in higher prices for everyday goods, lower prices, or have no impact? Now, even though if you follow, if you're listening to this podcast and you probably read other things, you'll know that most economists think that, you know, or know that increasing tariffs will lead to a result, will lead to an increase in prices. Most voters also know that. 68% of voters said it'll lead to higher prices, 7% lower prices, 12% no impact, and 13% admit they had no idea. Now, what's interesting is that when we say, do you think that U.S. increasing tariffs will generally help the U.S. economy, hurt the U.S. economy, or have no impact to the U.S. economy in the long run, right? So not just saying, you know, is it going to impact prices, but what's it going to do to the economy? Well, there we see 39% say it's going to help the economy in the long run, 44% say it's going to hurt the economy in the long run. So much closer. Now, if we look at Republicans, we see some pretty sophisticated attitudes, I would say. So nearly half, 48%, expect the tariffs to result in higher prices. A fifth, one in five, say that it'll be, have no impact. Another one in five say it'll have, that they just don't know, right? But again, the plurality, almost majority say higher prices. Now, long run, is it going to help or hurt the economy? Two-thirds say it's going to help the economy in the long run. And so if you think about, you know, the argument, you know, that Trump was making last night about the fact that you're essentially, you know, in some ways, you know, we're going to build it here. You know, this is a reorganization of the economy, and this is going to take some time. Well, that message is actually...
Seems to be resonating.
Yeah. And this is not, I mean, this is sophisticated. I mean, this is sort of surprising to find this kind of short-term, long-term thinking about this. Now, again, it's easy to say it in the abstract. If prices start going up, given what we know about the rest of the economic stuff we're going to get into, there's going to be some hard, you know, realities.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's an interesting, you know, I mean, it's very consistent, again, with the way that the Trump team has been selling this.
Yeah.
Right. You think about last night, you know, one of the, as I understand it, one of the few improvised, you know, he stuck unusually close to the script last night. But one of the things he did improvise towards the end, which I remember pretty clearly, was this moment where he said, look, there's going to, you know, it's going to be rough for a while.
Yeah.
I can't remember what the phrasing was.
Yeah.
But he acknowledged, you know, this may go poorly for a bit.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they've been selling the long-term model, you know, as a kind of a trade regime change. Obviously, they're not using those terms. You know, for a while, and I think you're right, Josh, it's clearly sunk in with his partisans.
Right. Now, the problem, you know, if you will, is the fact that—
It might not be right.
Well, it might not be right, and it's hitting people, you know, where they tell us it hurts. And so, and there's,
yes.
So there's two pieces of this. So one, I already mentioned, you know, there's these national economic attitudes. And what we see if we look at sort of overall, you know, we see an improvement from last year. I mean, most of those, the improvement in attitudes we already saw in December, essentially once people knew the regime was changing, like it was there. So you know, basically throughout much of last year, about 50% of voters in Texas said that the economy is worse compared to the prior year. If we look at December of last year and this most recent poll, it's 40%, 39%. So it's about, you know, a 10-point drop. Now, not surprisingly, even in December, only 16% of Republicans said that they expected the national economy to get better. By February, it's 50%. Among Democrats, who, you know, again, same situation, 22% said that the economy was worse compared to last year in December, just in December. In February, it's 67% say it's worse. Now, we see this all the time. I suggest people go look at our trend graphics on sort of national economic attitudes, and you can see changes in the administration. Much more positive about the future if you're a Republican, right? So we go from 32%, yeah, we're going to have a better economy in a year, to 78%. For Democrats, the share who say it's going to be worse went from 14% to 63%. So one thing you have to say is you take all that with a grain of salt. The challenge here is that attitudes towards the Texas economy, basically static and not super great. You know, 28% said it's better, 32% worse. That's about where we've been. Personal economic situation, 24% of people say they're better off compared to last year, 33% say they're worse off. The rest say they're in the middle, basically haven't changed. Pretty much static. And that goes to the thing, you know, all the changes that happen at the national level don't translate through to people's lived experiences in Texas, where nothing has really changed at the political level. And economically, people's concerns, if anything, have gotten a little bit higher over time. 70% were very concerned about prices in December. 73% are very concerned today. 68% about the cost of healthcare. 60% about the cost of housing. None of these like concerns just changed because the occupant in the White House changed hands, because ultimately people are still paying these things and you can't tell them that the prices are lower.
Yeah, there's something about specificity and the immediacy of the impact in the terms of questions, and we've talked about this in here a lot. We expect partisanship to affect these macro level, particularly the national macro level assessments. Mm-hmm. Right. But, you know, they're much more diluted when you give people D-I-L-U-T-E-D. They're much more diluted when we give people specific instances for them to think about of in the economy, right? Yeah.
Let me try to be brief, but start general and then go granular, because Josh covered a lot of ground in there from macro attitudes all the way down to how people view tariffs. At the macro level, there's an indicator that's highly, highly correlated with economic evaluations. It's the right direction or wrong track question. And the change that you get, and this is an interesting question in that people didn't automatically adjust their expectations or evaluations after the election, because you were still talking about where the country was right now. So in December of 2024, we had 56 wrong track, 31 right direction. That's minus 25. In the most recent poll, we're at 43 wrong track, 48 right direction, plus 5. That's a 30-point shift in the track question. Mm-hmm. So, and I would sort of give a shorthand to the data that Josh characterized, I think very accurately, from 2024 leading into 2025, which is when asked about kind of how things were going to be, a big chunk said they don't know, and they were waiting for the result of the election. So you couldn't get a lot of leverage on future casting in mid to late 2024. But what's pretty fascinating is that once the election happened, the numbers turned, as you would expect, where Republicans said, okay, now I know that Trump's president, I'm optimistic. Not as many Democrats said, oh, Trump's elected, now I'm pessimistic. Now, that was directionally what happened, but the latter did not compensate for the former. So you've had these dramatic shifts in what I would call macro attitudes. Now, the economy is a performance issue, and that's where we are right now. I was the great question that I think Josh deserves credit for on here is a split sample where he asked people about, you know, do you think we're going to see a price increase because of the tariffs? And then was A. And then B, another half of the sample, got, do you think in the long term it helps or hurts? It would have been interesting if we could have had a three-way split where we asked people, you know, some version got, are prices going to go up? Another version got, is it going to help jobs in the United States? And then the third one, which was just long term, how do you weigh those two things right in combination? Josh is right. The people have complex attitudes on tariffs. Actually, a little smarter than I might have thought. You know,
me too.
I was skeptical that people would kind of get the arguments. The Democratic argument about the price effect, I think, is a real Achilles heel for Trump right now, because it's a major part of his economic policy, and the Democrats have been messaging smartly on that. You know, you're going to own inflation. You're going to own inflation. You're going to own prices once this kicks in. That I would argue that is maybe the only coherent message the Democrats have kind of had in the last 3 or 4 months. I think it's sort of working here.
You know, I was going to say, so two things. I want to come back to jobs, but while you're still there, I was going to say, you know, one thing that I noticed last night in the speech that I think is one of the areas where the Democrats are coherent but could, you know, walk into the buzzsaw is if there's a government shutdown and if Trump is somehow successful in blaming them for it. Because he was sort of laying the groundwork for that last night. And, you know, given, again, the sort of the ineffectual nature and the lack of unity in the Democratic response, it remains sort of a question as to whether in a cage match over who wins that battle, you know, Democrats are just going to win because the party out of power always wins that fight. We'll see. I mean, right, like a lot of things have happened. But I would say if the government does shut down and if Trump is successful at casting some or all of the blame on Democrats, the blame for inflation is going to fall right behind that. Yeah, you know why things are bad now? Because the Democrats don't want to like agree on anything because they want to shut the government down. So I think that's one way he does it. One of the things you mentioned was jobs. And I want to point this out because it was something, you know, I code all these. We've been asking more open-ended questions in the poll, at least one almost in every survey, to try to get a top-of-mind consideration. And I code them. So I have to read them all, which is interesting.
Open-ended, just for the audience's sake, is a question where we don't provide them with response options. We just say, right, what do you think about this?
Yeah,
and then poor Josh has to go in and you know, characterize them in a coherent way.
Some of them are funny. Some of them are scary. They're all, you know, they can all be interesting. But one of the things that I've noticed, and I was going to ask you about this in terms of the national polling, is that, you know, the economic concern in the open ended, you know, at least in, especially in October going into the election, and even December to a large extent, you know, it was prices. I'm like, prices, you know, things are too expensive, got to get prices down. This was the first one where I was like, there was a lot more presence of jobs. There seemed to be a little bit more of an uptick in concern about the availability of jobs, which we hadn't seen because we were, you know, we are talking about, you know, jobs are there. It's just that everything costs too much. But I am starting to see a little bit of a concern around the job market. I'm wondering if you're seeing any of that in the national
stuff. We have seen it a little bit in the national. And, you know, the messaging tends to emphasize things like high-paying or high-quality jobs,
right,
and things like that. It is a maybe not the flip side of the inflation coin, but,
yeah,
you know, if prices rise to a certain point and my job is limited in terms of how much compensation, mm-hmm, I'm getting, it these things are related. I think it's curious that the Democrats have moved, I think, smartly to emphasizing prices now that they're no longer in power. Mm-hmm. Republicans seem to be moving towards jobs in a way that I think, I'm with you, Josh, if I'm reading your suspicion right, that it could be very smart, but it needs to be kind of a broad, holistic messaging on the economy, which is, why would you impose tariffs? Because you think jobs are being lost to these other countries because they have unfair advantages and things like that. It all gets back to, can Trump make the case that he's doing things that are going to help the lower and middle class?
Right.
That's the key. And prices is a huge part of that. Jobs are another part of it. But you have to render it in a way that right, the average voter says, like, yeah, Trump's working for me. I think a lot of the bump right now, just to kind of maybe close the circle a little bit, is we weren't getting anything out of the Biden administration on this. Nothing. And I think that's kind of the key difference right now. I mean, we will see whether Trump's messaging works. But it's you know, with all apologies to the last president, it's better than going off to Rehoboth Beach every weekend and not saying anything on the economy and just voters,
yeah,
just, I mean,
don't Trump manages to golf a lot, but say a lot too.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I don't see as much movement in the job numbers as you guys are seeing, at least apart from what we're, at least in the state numbers.
Now, Josh and I are canaries in the coal mine.
Yeah. Apart from what else, you know, I mean, the movement doesn't seem much bigger than what we saw in the other areas. You know, I mean, to all that, I mean, there's nothing I sort of disagree with. I mean, look, we're seeing general signs of economic trouble on the horizon, right? But I think, you know, I'm still struck by the persistent rank of price concerns across the board, which we also saw in December, mm-hmm, right? And that, you know, when you have 73% very concerned about the price of, you know, consumer goods, basically, you know, up within the margin, only up 3 points from December, but, you know, didn't go down. And December was a little optimistic, probably generally in terms of mood, which we've commented on here, but, you know, followed in the rankings of the shares who are very or even very and somewhat concerned, you know, it's all cost issues at the top four.
Right. Yeah, and they've all gone up significantly since before the election. I mean, just
right,
to say that out loud. I mean, not like, you know, we're not saying 20 points or something because they're already high, right?
Right.
But if you're looking at, you know, concern over the cost of housing, very concerned. You know, April was 59, December or October is 55, then 58, then 60, right? I mean, you know, right, cost of healthcare 61, yeah, back in October. Now it's 67, 68, the last two measures. And even, you know, the concern over the cost of food in October and August of last year was below 70%, and it's been 70 or higher in the last two,
right,
polls.
Well, I think we've already seen a comparison of what wins out, in, at least in this context, when it's a prices versus jobs,
yeah,
fight. I mean, that was the last election.
At least in this environment, right? Right? For
but,
sure.
But just, yeah, to put a little data behind, you know, just our intuition about, or, you know, kind of reading of the open-ended data, August last year, the percent very concerned about people who want to work being able to find jobs, 39% very concerned, 42% in December, 45% in February.
Right.
It's not you're right, Jim. It's not a huge increase, but it's trending.
Yeah, I mean,
up
it's
bit
there. I mean, yeah, and again, there's you know, clearly if you read the economic news, there's an objective correlate to this,
right?
Right. That's not huge, but seems like it could be building. You know, I think in a lot of ways, this brings us back to where, you know, you kind of went earlier, Darren, which is, you know, how you parse out what is clearly something that, you know, is prevalent in the national environment, prevalent in the state environment in terms of these concerns about prices, and how they play differentially at the state and national level. Right. Because as you guys have both said, I mean, you said, you know, the possible Achilles heel, you know, this issue is just hanging out there. It's going to be what defines the second half of the Trump term. However long they sustain the pace and the aggressiveness they have now, if the numbers are still looking like this and the economic number, the inflation numbers have not gone down, and there's a compound effect of the tariffs that, you know, with a lag or, you know, but they made the lag may actually not be very long on this. If they stick
according to Target, next week.
If they stick with where they are now, right? And then this is going to continue to loom large. But at play, even though these are all Texas numbers we're talking about, you know, there's not a lot the Texas legislature can do about prices. Mm-hmm. Even though when we ask people what they want the legislature to act on, prices, you know, lowering prices is up there. Right.
No, I mean, I think what's really like sort of fascinating in this moment, and maybe you guys react to that, just a thought. So I don't really have, it's not like a finished thing, but
inductive theorizing.
Yeah, maybe you guys can take it somewhere. But I mean, it is really interesting to watch, you know, like let's say, you know, the Republican state officials, members of the legislature, you know, essentially fall in line behind, you know, wherever Trump is headed on anything for the most part. You know, I mean, there are people who, you know.
We have a Doge committee.
Yeah, we have a Doge committee, right? You know, but what it is interesting is we sort of go towards tariffs and a lot of people are like, well, you know, Texas does, you know, rely on trade a lot, you know, and sort of point out, you know, it's like our GDP is bigger than Russia, you know, like we have a lot going on here and we're going to be affected, you know, more than a lot of other states. And it is really interesting that essentially you have the Republican government, it's in Austin, they're meeting right now, and we're almost just kind of pretending this is not happening. I mean, it's almost like the measles outbreak, you know, it's just like we're walking right into this thing where, you know, and if anything, you know, he's got members of his own party cheering him on. But what is this going to look like in 6 months?
Yeah, I mean, there's
months?
A card in the Axios local mailers this morning about, you know, with some data on the dependence of Texas on binational trade with Mexico, which is huge.
Well, you pointed this out a lot, too. We talked about this before, but it's like there's that. There's the dependence of Texas on federal funding. You know? I mean, there's a lot of ways that Texas stands to really, you know, be hurt by this. And you know, and because it's coming from the same party, there's not really a lot of pushback going on right now. But I think that's actually maybe we'll see. But like if this does manifest in some, you know, significantly higher prices, like it's going to be a pretty rude awakening for a lot of people, right?
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't even call this inductive, impulsive theorizing, but it's not even theorizing, but it does remind me of the second part of the Bush term. I mean, you sort of emphasized the Katrina dip, but, you know, everything seems pretty good, but then it's not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it can turn on you in a way that is not necessarily, you know, that can be very surprising. Put it that way.
Yeah. Uncontrollable. At a certain point.
You know, we study politics and we study public opinion. And I think in doing that, you inevitably end up getting doses of humility as you try to figure out what's going to happen. This one has so many moving parts.
Yeah.
You're talking about maybe a deal with Russia, you know, the energy plan that the Trump administration has, right? You got the Doge efforts going on. You've got these looming, you know, tax cut renewals that are kind of hanging over things right now. You've got these tariffs. And I'm fascinated with economists who said, oh, this is clearly going to do this or that. I don't think it's clearly going to do anything. I really do think there's so many things that could come together. So, you know, back to inductive reasoning. In a year and a half, we'll probably go like, well, it was clear that if you're going to raise tax, you know, if you're going to keep the tax cuts and have tariffs and, you know, you're going to cut these government, that of course that was going to be inflationary. And on the other hand, it could go completely the other, oh, they got these tariff deals, you know, after putting a pressure to Canada and Mexico.
Right.
And this energy renewal has lowered gas prices and, you know.
Or prices are down because we're in a recession and everybody's looking for jobs. And it's a different thing.
Yeah. No, you know? Exactly. And I think all of these things are on the table. And, you know, from a political perspective, And politics are really critical here, not just for marshaling support for your program, but also communicating what you're doing to an American public that is jittery over high prices.
Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, it's the administration's responsibility, and to a lesser extent in Texas, this has to be done at the state level, to communicate, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing to try to address the issues that people think are critically important? The contrast here between the economy, where it's complex and we sort of have a to-be-determined attitude, is on immigration and border security, where I think they've been very effective at communicating what they're doing. I don't even think they're doing as much.
Yeah.
I don't think it's even close.
They're certainly doing less than they promised.
Right, right. But I think there's, you know, the story, which is, oh, we're tightening the border. We're strengthening the border. And we're going after people who are here. It's an easier narrative, and I think people have already, especially Republicans, have already, I'm going to say swallowed it. I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but, you know.
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, you know, we haven't really talked about the immigration thing. Well, maybe we'll come back to moving on. But, I mean, one I would note about the immigration thing, one thing that's interesting is that, you know, the level of concern as, mm-hmm. you know, the flows at the border have gone to, you know, drip, drip, drip compared to the flood of the last, intermittent floods of the last couple of years. I mean, it's just lowered the temperature on the issue. I was looking at those numbers, talking to a reporter today and, you know, striving for the right quick.
Yeah, Republicans just moved over from line. Crisis to very serious, like 10 points.
Right. Well, you know, what I said to the reporter is like, you know, something like, you know, look, the numbers have cooled, but they've cooled from, you know, a raging fire to simply still burning, right? I mean, you know, but the MIP number at the state level for immigration and border security dipped below 50% for the first time mm-hmm. in among Republicans mm-hmm. for the first time in a long time.
Long time. Right.
You know, and still, so there are signs of this kind of glimmer in the forest on immigration. But, you know, I also want to come back. I mean, you know, I do want to press this question of, you know, I mean, Josh kind of talked about this a minute ago, but I'm curious what you think, Darren, actually, because, you know, lowering the cost of everyday goods and services was articulated as either an extremely or very important issue for the state legislature to prioritize.
Yeah.
You know, 81%, you know, tied with water and just below the 84% on reliability of the state's energy grid.
Which, by the way, still going nowhere, that issue.
Yeah, right. Not, in terms of not going away.
Yeah, just doesn't
now, go away. I would say I was going to go back and look. I think we were in the field during that cold snap, but there were no problems. But I think
it doesn't negate
the point that it takes nothing for people to worry about the grid now.
Yeah.
Right. Only the threat of things. So I am just, you know, I'm curious. I don't know how to parse out the fact that these economic concerns, you know, people are thinking about them globally right now because of the price thing, you know, mm-hmm. the cost thing in particular. That's the wording of the item was, mm-hmm. you know, legislature should address lowering the cost of everyday goods and services. Now, one might bark at us saying, well, they can't do that, but really nobody can. So
I think, but we have these issues all the time because we have a federal system.
Yeah.
So we're asking about, you know, is it reasonable for pollsters to ask whether the federal government ought to do more on education? We think it is, even though we're not dumb. Well, we are dumb, but we understand that education is the province of the states, that healthcare, elections, these are all state issues where the state is the major player. But it's not unreasonable to ask about the federal government.
No, I mean, look, the federal government, and, you know, yeah, Josh, you know, activated one of my hobby horses. I mean, look, we can say that, but the federal government pumps tons of money.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, the state is very dependent on that money.
And I
think what all of those policy areas look like at the state level reflects huge amounts of federal support.
So from, you know, from the audience point of view, just kind of draw you into our world a little bit, we've essentially decided that it's reasonable to ask about the federal government's performance or how big a priority the federal government ought to make certain issues, even though those issues are certainly constitutionally kind of the province of the states, at least primarily. This is what you're talking about, Jim and Josh, is an area in which the national government is the prime mover, and that is, you know, macroeconomic policy, tariffs that have an impact on people's finances. But I would say it's still legitimate, as, you know, we ask about state issues to the national government, to ask national issues to the state government.
Yeah.
But I would also concede that the toolkit that the Texas legislature has to affect these things is quite limited, especially compared to the national government's toolkit on state issues.
Sure.
You know, and so that makes it a kind of an interesting question about, you know, how much do we make of the fact that Texans say prices are a huge issue and because of that, would we say, boy, the Republicans are in trouble because the legislative agenda doesn't really have a whole lot.
Yeah. I mean, on whether, that. And, you know, look, whether it's fair or not, doesn't matter to the voters.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, you know, ask Joe Biden.
Yeah. Well, right? I think this is something
in terms of economy.
Yeah. This is something we've talked about, you know, looking ahead to state elections and, you know, the political dynamics and conversation that occurred in the state of Texas. You know, the main issue that voters have on their minds, immigration is one, but it's the economy, it's prices, et cetera. If this is a disastrous policy, if there's a recession or if prices go up, let alone stay as high as they are, the Republicans are not just in trouble nationally. They're in trouble in Texas.
They're under more pressure certainly than they're used to, you know.
Exactly. I don't mean
used to feeling from the outside, right?
Exactly.
I mean, they've been causing themselves a lot of trouble in the last election cycle, but
right. And this stuff, if it happens early enough, compounds, which is Democratic donors and volunteers and activists get energized and maybe field candidates and contest races at the state house level that they might otherwise have taken a pass on. And, you know, this is why there was some kind of hushed conversations in Texas about how much do they really want Trump to win? How much do state Republicans really want Trump to win in 2024? Because his victory means the Republicans
it's
own everything. And
when you're following whatever.
Well, you're at Trump, if there's anything state Republicans should know, like every other Republican in the country, you are at Donald Trump's mercy.
Yeah.
Right now, in terms of what they decide to do, let's go to our dealer's choice session. We were going to, you know, we'll come back and talk about more of these results in future podcasts. So, curious, you know, as we always do, what'd you guys pull out of this? What, what that we haven't talked about much, or that we have talked about, you think is we've not given enough importance to? What stood out in the poll? Josh, let's start with you.
Yeah, you know, I mean, one of the things I really enjoy about working on this project and having worked on it for so long is the fact that we get to go back to the well, which doesn't just mean that we get to do less work because we don't have to write a new question, but we get to, like, look at these results along another dimension. So you can look at the results within to see the differences by partisanship. But by looking at it over time, you get this other, you know, sort of way to sort of interpret the results. And sometimes it gives you something that, you know, is totally makes sense. And sometimes you say, oh, that's interesting. And that's the stuff that I really love. So one of those is this, which is that we asked this question in November of 2015, so a little less than 10 years ago. And again today, in the February poll, we said, as you may know, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution states that all children born in the United States are automatically U.S. citizens regardless of their parents' legal status. Would you favor or oppose changing the Constitution to repeal this part of the 14th Amendment? So we basically asked about, how about removing birthright citizenship, which has been proposed and sort of rejected,
well,
at least by
decreed,
the courts.
I think.
Decreed and rejected by the courts. But we've asked about this. We asked about 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, 48% of voters favored repealing basically birthright citizenship. 39% were opposed to this. 13% had no opinion. Asking this question again, I had, you know, thought, if I had to bet, it would have gone up. But in fact, the opposite. It went down. Today, 36% said they favored repealing this part of the 14th Amendment. 48% oppose repealing this part of the 14th Amendment, so they flipped. And what you're seeing is just, again, sort of a couple of things here. Republicans did not move a lot. You saw, again, more Democrats in opposition to repealing, but you also see more opposition from Hispanics, more opposition from African Americans. So in some ways, what actually I think has happened is that these sorts of issues have become more the fodder of public discussion as opposed to kind of, I would almost say, fringy discussions.
Yeah.
People have come to, you know, basically make evaluations of it based on their own experiences, their own politics, whatever.
Immediate reality of the question.
But the interesting thing is the state actually kind of liberalized on this question over the last 10 years, which I think is pretty fascinating given the broader context we're discussing.
What it tells me is we're going to have to ask it again.
Yeah.
Right.
Probably.
A couple of months, probably.
Probably. You can't make a trend with two.
How about you, Darren?
There were two broad questions that caught my attention. And I'll leave one, but just I will point it out. You know, we asked about a list of concerns and priorities for K-12 education and the dominance of school safety. Other concerns came up, curriculum reform, teacher pay, et cetera, always very, very highly rated. But man, school safety was just above and beyond. So that was my runner-up. You know,
that's been a fairly consistent feature of this battery
since at least Uvalde.
Since Uvalde.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And by the way, that jibes with data I've seen on Hispanic samples. Mm-hmm. It's just a huge priority. Again, since Uvalde, and actually a little earlier. But I'm going to go with a vaunted Q31 for those of you playing along at home. we asked about, do each of the following state taxes have a major, minor, or no impact on your personal finances. We asked this just a couple years ago. So this is the last lead session, February 2023. And
it's almost like we did that on purpose.
I know. It's almost like some foresight.
It's nuts.
And what was fascinating is that the percentage of the Texas electorate, voting public, that said these taxes had a major impact on their personal finances jumped by about 10 percentage points across the board. So sales tax, last time around, 41% said major impact, 51% this time.
That's probably going to be attached to inflation, right, also.
I think so. Well, I think so.
Let's get through the rest.
Although inflation was a big deal, bigger deal at the time. But 58% said the property tax had a major impact, 23%. 68% this time.
That's
right?
Amazing.
Other taxes, the business tax went from 20 major to 25 this time. Almost nothing. The excise taxes on alcohol and tobacco didn't move much. But a 10-point jump of people saying,
and these are the high impact tax. I mean,
exactly. So I
think high incidence tax.
And I know Jim wants to talk about this because we spoke briefly. He said, like, what do you got? And I mentioned this. He goes, that was mine. So I'm interested in what Jim's.
Well, I mean, look, it was more, you know, podcast host than inductive theorizing. But I mean, when I look at this, to me, this is one of the answers to the, how do we think about where national conditions and national politics and all these concerns and prices? You know, I think it makes sense to see this, you know, at least provisionally as part and parcel of these concerns about prices. If you're watching prices and you're watching your expenditures, you know, you're going to be more sensitive to tax expenditures, which are big. So if you're going to the supermarket, you know, it's likely that when you go, you know, oh man, these eggs or whatever eggs are, you know, these eggs are expensive. And this, you know, what I hear from people all the time, this bag of groceries costs me twice as much. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you're paying almost twice as much or a big proportion higher in sales tax too. So it makes sense to me that people are going to notice this and be more sensitive to it. And to me, it's part of the follow-up to our notion that, look, you know, on one hand, you know, elected officials only have so much impact over this stuff, even at the federal level, and yet it finds its way into the political bloodstream.
I think this is like one of the great results of this survey. And part of it is the time thing, and I'll just say why. And it really ties together everything we've been talking about here, right? Voters are concerned about the economy. They're concerned about the prices. We ask them what the legislature should do. A large share of them say they should be focusing on the economy. However, we've got to, you know, this is Texas, right? This is a low taxes, low services state. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, there is no ideological fuel to, like, let's say, have the government go out and do a bunch of stuff. That's just not in the bloodstream here, you know, to use that again. On the other side, you know, if you want to believe that, like, well, you know, it's government spending that's led to this price increase. Well, again, you know, Texas can't really draw back a bunch of spending because we don't spend that much on a bunch of, you know, stuff outside of the things we spend money on. So what does that solution look like? Well, it looks like property tax reduction, right? We're gonna hit you at the bottom line. We're gonna deal with both your housing and your issue about, you know, costs, prices, whatever. But here's the issue: they've been doing it, and people actually still think it's a problem. In fact, it's gone up.
Yeah.
Even though they've been making efforts at this repeatedly over the last really decade to bring the property taxes down.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this all the time. It just has to do with the fact that, you know, all kinds of things. It's another podcast, but talking about
I was about to
talk about all the drivers.
The rate has increased, but the absolute value that people are
Well, you know, appraisals and, you know.
The thing is, this can break both ways. And this is just to be fair, again, about which we don't know. Because look, if the economy goes in a negative direction and housing values go down, well, all of a sudden people are going to get an even bigger tax cut on their property taxes, and the legislators will say, hey, we did that for you.
Right.
Now your house is worth less. I guess, you know, people make that trade-off.
Right, right.
But I think this is the whole point. It's not a straight line from, let's say, increasing, you know, the value of the homestead exemption to a voter saying, hey, I've got more money in my pocket and the legislature really addressed my concerns.
Thanks, guys. And we've asked whether people felt it and they don't. And look, they're aware of this. I mean, the lieutenant governor has been very explicit in wanting to drive as large a property tax reduction to as broad a base as he possibly can.
Yep.
Yeah. And the data here, I mean, look, we're talking about, you know, 68%, almost 7 in 10 said property tax has a major impact on their personal finances. And, you know, if you look at the question we asked about the Texas Legislature's actions on this, you know, you're getting 60% who said that the Texas Legislature efforts on this had some impact on their personal finances. 25%, 1 in 4, said a major impact. So,
That's an interesting way of reading those numbers. Yeah, I mean, I often read them the other way.
I know.
But
I know.
That makes
sense. I did
no,
too,
that, but that's a smart way to do that, I think.
Yeah, and I think Republicans will look at that, and you're right. They're not done with this.
Well, and I would also say even beyond that, Democrats look at that.
Yeah.
You know, you're not, you know, Democrats are not standing up in the Texas legislature by and large to lead the fight against property tax relief and do something else.
Yeah. And I looked at this recently from the last set of polling on this, and, you know, and as popular as is reducing or important as much importance as Republicans place on reducing property taxes for the legislature, Democrats also would like to see the legislature reduce property taxes. Yeah.
Well, because, you know, look, you don't get a sales tax bill at the end of the year.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, incrementalism of that is, I think, important. So what did I arrive at? You know, since Darren shameless, no, I gave it to Darren, but I gave it up because I'm such a generous colleague.
You're a surrender monkey. So.
I'm a surrender monkey, exactly. You know, the other thing that I'm going to pull out of here then is something that I've been talking, I've kind of raised this with a couple of groups I've talked to lately. I think I brought it up in here in the last poll, but also the degree to which healthcare and health expenses mm-hmm. are lurking in people's sense of concerns. You know, we've seen it. Josh and I did a project for, you know, limited for some business folks, loomed very large in that survey that we did last year. But in this, I mean, and there's a, you know, in the same couple of places, right? Healthcare ranked high and the healthcare costs
access.
Ranked high on the list of economic concerns. And doing something about availability of healthcare, access to healthcare, was also pretty high in the legislative concerns at the state level. So we're seeing that out there. And it feels to me like, on one hand, healthcare is always kind of out there. You know, since the ACA, it hasn't broken through. But I kind of, you know, it's a spidey sense thing maybe based with some, you know, this is definitely inductive prediction. But I mean, it does feel like there's something out there that is kind of it's multiple points of contact. It's cost, it's accessibility, it's insurance, it's prescriptions. It's all of these things that people are kind of going, you know, this is really...
Well,
it's expensive also, and not working very well.
Let's say
for
it's
me.
Performance of the system, right? I mean, even if you do have good coverage, nobody really says, "Boy, that was really easy and great and clear," right? The other thing I'll point out, you know, that's interesting, I think, in this is just for people who are interested in this topic, is if you look back, as I was looking back at this recently, because we have a lot of healthcare polling, especially during the efforts of the last Trump administration to repeal the ACA and sort of looking at people's senses of the alternatives and all these things. This is not to say that I think Republicans are open for a universal healthcare system. But when you do ask questions about alternatives to the current system and you do ask questions about, potential universal systems, it's surprising how split Republican attitudes have become on a lot of that stuff, at least what I've seen. I don't know if that's what you've seen, where, you're not going to see, 75-80% of Republicans saying, nope, this employer-based insurance system is great. It's just not what you see. Now, it doesn't mean that they're saying like, hey, let's expand Obamacare. Let's, that's not what that's saying. But the frustration with the system is just kind of everywhere.
Yeah, there's a bipartisan consensus that the system is broken.
Yeah.
And I think that's right. The same way you mentioned that Democrats aren't up screaming, to raise property taxes, Republicans aren't exactly leaping to the defense of the healthcare system right now.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
right.
That was my thing. I mean, I think it's, I keep seeing that, and it's just kind of risen to the point that, is somebody going to do something with this?
It's risen a little bit above the norm. I mean, you said, there's always a certain floor of attention to healthcare, and that's because there's people who are chronically ill and for whom, the system is just a nightmare, right? And but it's a little bit above that floor. It's been ticking up.
I think that's right. So with that, Darren, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure, Jim.
I hope your
always.
Week gets better.
Yeah. It's on the upswing already.
I think you did a great job in here.
Thank you, man.
Attaboy.
Thank you, man. I'm feeling seen.
Good. Well, perfect.
Josh, as always, thanks for all the work prepping us for this and doing the lifting here. Thanks, as always, to our esteemed colleagues here in the audio studio, in the dev studio in LAITS and the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. The polling we're talking about today, all findable at our newly refreshed and more accessible website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Go check that out. You can download, everything related to this poll, results, cross tabs, thousands of free to download and now easier to find graphics. You can use our search engine to look for specific results. You can check out our latest poll page. You can check out our blog that will have that has an extensive write-up of these results and more. So with that, Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week on the next episode of Inductive Theorizing. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.